From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn why hazelnuts could be the solution to Wisconsin's loss of dairy farms. Then we'll speak with the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District about the changes made to the city's green infrastructure.
I think we're starting to see kind of an integrated benefit where we're seeing fewer overflows of wastewater to the rivers. We're seeing less homes flooded. It's very satisfying to see.
Plus, WUWM Eric Von Fellow Nadia Kelly joins us to share what inspired her upcoming series called Reflections of Representation.
I was just really interested in the idea of public art as like an entryway to a larger conversation about people, our relationship to where we live, and how that all influences our identity.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. A new crop is taking root in the upper Midwest, hazelnuts. Many curious farmers are drawn to the novelty of a native nut. Farmland in the upper Midwest is mostly used for corn and soybeans, and most hazelnuts are grown overseas. Perennial crops like hazelnuts bring many climate benefits. They suck up agricultural pollution and lock up planet warming carbon, and they hold on to soil that otherwise quickly erodes from farmland. WUWM's Lena Tran went to a farm in Plymouth, Wisconsin, where farmers gathered to learn about the crop. We'll hear from some of those farmers first, then Lena speaks with Jason Fishbach from the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. It's a research hub that formed to support this emerging industry.
I'm Deborah.
I do love the plant. I like growing them. I haven't had great success because of the critters, but it still gets me out and I'm learning a lot and enjoying it. I think it was just because it's a perennial crop and I was excited to think about how that could be a very helpful thing for the soils and for wildlife.
Tom Grip. I just started growing them about 20 years ago. Initially, for the first 10 years, it was just a complete hobby. And now that I've retired, it's my retirement hobby is planting hazelnuts and various other sorts of fruit and berry. Where I live in the Driftless area, we have terrible problems with soil erosion. And every time I turn the soil over, a lot of it washes away. So I have the good fortune to own some land. And so I just thought I'd look into planting different things.
My name is Jan.
Are you already like...
My husband and I have 5 acres up near Shiocton, and he's got about 300 trees in right now. Pat with the green bandana.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know what she told you, but we ran a professional landscape service for lawn maintenance and landscape service for over 20 years. So we were in the green industry. We moved from landscaping to farming, hobby farm, obviously, small. 5 acres, and we started with apples, and by visiting the apple seminars in the universities, you go to hazelnuts real quick, and you find Jason, and he runs an excellent program, and at this point, I wish I didn't have the apple trees, and I just had all hazelnuts.
Really? What is it about hazelnuts?
I think they're just going to be so easy to grow, and the uniqueness.
The uniqueness because it's from here.
Uniqueness as in you can't really find anybody that has a hazelnut field like you can an apple field. Being from Appleton, there's probably 20 orchards within 10 minutes of the city. I think we're the only hazelnut orchard within 10 minutes from the city. The biggest challenge, of course, there's always the money, but to do it right. And again, Jason and everybody at the university have been wonderful telling us the correct way to do it so you don't have to rip it out and do it again and rip it out and do it again. So hopefully we're doing it right the first time.
Jason Fishbach with the University of Wisconsin Madison Division of Extension, and I'm the Emerging Crops Outreach Specialist.
What is your hazelnut origin story?
I don't even remember anymore.
Because it's been so long?
Yeah, pretty much. So I got interested in hazelnuts when I was in grad school back in 2003. But then when I moved up to Ashland and took a job with UW Extension as the agriculture agent, for the two counties, one of my charges was to help diversify the ag economy up here. Our rural counties, far away from markets, like elsewhere in the country, well, in Wisconsin, has seen a decline in the number of small and medium-sized dairy herds. So for example, in Bayfield County, we went from 120 to about 5 dairy farms. You know, it's just complete collapse of the dairy economy. So we needed to find other options for farmers and for the ag economy, and started looking around, and turns out that there's this plant that grows wild all over Bayfield County called American hazelnut. So the analog to cranberries is really pretty good, because cranberries, that industry started from a plant that was growing in the wild. And so at the time I naively thought, oh, no problem, we'll just turn American hazelnut into a crop just like we did with cranberries. But easier said than done. So we're still working at it. Ultimately, the goal is to develop the hazelnut industry in the upper Midwest, centered around the American hazelnut germplasm. And it turns out it has all kinds of other climate benefits if we can do this at scale.
Yeah. So germplasm, meaning you're using some of the genetic material from what's growing in the wild and trying to breed that with other things to work better for commercial purposes?
Exactly. Yeah. So there's two approaches to our breeding program. The first is just simple search and screen. You know, no one's ever looked at these wild American hazelnut populations for really nice plants, plants that could support commercial production, large nuts, good production year to year, good pest resistance. So we've started doing that in 2007, I think, is when we first started, you know, just tromping around the woods looking for cool plants, make copies of it. That's trying to develop cultivars of pure American hazelnut. Then the other approach, which was farther along when we started, because a lot of our early adopters and private breeders started, I mean, it goes back 100 years, but they crossed the European hazelnut, which supplies 99.99% of the global hazelnut market. They crossed European hazelnut with American hazelnut to try to get the best of both worlds, because European hazelnut can't survive the winters or disease pressure up here, but American hazelnut just doesn't produce large enough nuts for hazelnut markets. So the goal is to combine the traits of two and come up with the good cultivars that growers can grow. We've done it. We've got our top 5 to 10 cultivars that we have identified from that breeding work. And I'm actually standing in a greenhouse today where we're working on propagation to try to make more copies of these for growers, because it turns out it's really hard to propagate, which has slowed down our industry a lot.
Huh. Well, you mentioned some of those benefits that you discovered along the way. Can you dig into why hazelnuts are so compelling as we consider, you know, what it looks like for Wisconsin agriculture to adapt to climate change?
Sure. Okay, so the first is the actual change in carbon dynamics from agricultural landscapes, right? And this is big. For this to work, it has to be at a big scale. And there's a lot of factors at play whether or not this will actually happen. But we know that a transition from a meat-based to a plant-based diet is one really effective tool to reduce carbon emissions from agriculture lands. And hazelnuts are a super protein source. So if more people ate nuts and ate less meat, then we could reduce carbon emissions. Okay, but there's a lot of variables in that, right? But that's one benefit to hazelnuts, because we don't really have a nut crop for the upper Midwest, particularly Wisconsin and Minnesota. And so this would be our region's first nut crop. The second thing then would be, if it's deployed at scale, we reduce tillage, and we can actually build soil organic matter and fix more carbon, both in the plants themselves, but also reductions in soil disturbance, because this is a long-lived perennial crop, you know, that will live for 100 years easily. Okay, so you got carbon sequestration benefits potentially. Then on the other side is carbon mitigation, right? So we're dealing with larger storm events, more erosive storm events. And anytime we can keep roots in the ground with perennial plants, that's just going to help protect those soils from storm events and the runoff events that we keep getting more and more of.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't necessarily need as big a scale if you do it strategically. If you put these woody perennials in areas that are particularly conducive to erosion, or put it in ways that you can at least stop the soil from upstream from moving further downstream. So strip plantings, riparian buffers, planting on slopes, all that kind of stuff. So that's why we're excited about hazelnuts as a crop. Of course, this goes nowhere unless people start eating hazelnuts. So part of this also is market development.
Right. And what does that look like for you?
At the end of the day, this is up to farmers and consumers to figure out. But at the university, we're just trying to set the stage for success, applying lessons that we've learned from other crops. So one thing we know is for a capital-intensive crop like hazelnuts, it's really helpful if you're clustered with other growers, because then it makes it way easier to share things like harvesting equipment, processing equipment. It makes it easier to pool volume so you can access bigger markets. When we get small plantings scattered all over the place, it can make it really hard to develop efficient supply chains. So by working with our grower community up front here and trying to encourage them or help them form grower clusters, that's a big part of what we're trying to do. And that sets the stage then for, hopefully, they can access bigger markets at price points that consumers can pay, and they also can make money. The game then from a profitability standpoint is, if farmers are just selling a commodity and all of the upstream value added is owned by other people, not the growers, then the growers just aren't going to be successful. So we're trying to help the growers own that value chain so they can capture as much of that retail food dollar as they can, because it's going to make their system better. So that's where something like the American Hazelnut Company, we formed that in 2014. So it gives an opportunity for their member growers to own that value chain and actually produce a value-added product that they can take to market. Because one thing we've seen is, as other industries, other hazelnut production regions grow, oftentimes they're left to just selling to the biggest buyers, and that would be Ferrero.
Maker of the delicious chocolates.
Yep. And roughly 40% of the world's hazelnut supply goes to Nutella. And so, you know, Nutella is a huge product. They have to have low prices. They really squeeze their suppliers. And so you get paid global commodity prices.
Right.
We would rather our growers produce Nutella, you know, or some version of it, some high grossing, high margin, value added hazelnut product that they own from production of the nuts all the way to the, to the sale, to, you know, retail sale to the consumer. Long story short, we're just trying to apply other successes from other industries to our fledgling hazelnut industry, try to set them up for success.
This is WUWM's Lena Tran, and you're listening to Lake Effect. My guest is Jason Fishbach. He's with the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. So this hub of researchers and emerging crop specialists, it started back in 2007. I'm curious, what is the challenge that kind of defines this phase of the work?
We launched in 2007, and by far the number one priority was genetics, plant breeding, trying to develop improved cultivars. And now that we've at least progressed there, the number one bottleneck by far is propagation. If we can't get copies of these good plants out to growers, we've got nothing. So that's why, you know, that's where I spend most of my time these days, is trying to figure this out, try to find methods and nursery partners and everybody else to stand up a team that can get these plants produced. And we're making progress, but it's still way too slow. To give you some perspective where we're at, our goal is 20,000 acres by 2030. That's going to require 9 million plants. Right now, we're producing maybe a 1,500 to 2,000 a year. So we've got a long way to go.
And this is just kind of like a quirk of the plant itself.
It's hard to get. So there's different methods that you use, but a pretty common one is via stem cuttings. So you take a piece off the mother plant and you stick it in soil with some rooting hormone, and ideally it grows roots and then continues growing. This is how it's done with many different industries. Hazelnuts don't do that. We're making progress figuring out a protocol for how to do it, but it's not working very well.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that woody crop industries are propagated, tissue culture, where you're generating a new cell from a single bud and you're doing it in the lab and then growing out those microplants. And hazelnuts also don't do well in tissue culture. It appears it has something to do with American hazelnut, which is, we think, because it's adapted to really dry, sandy soils, its stress response is to just stop growing and go dormant.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing we want the plant to do when it's being propagated, it needs to be actively growing. So anytime we take a cutting or do something as part of the propagation process, we're disturbing that plant. It's in stress mode, and so it stops growing. So that's what we're fighting against, is that an American hazelnut. But of course, it's not all American hazelnut plants, right? There's some genotypes that are relatively easy to propagate. Just turns out it's not the ones that we want to propagate.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Like, what is your relationship with hazelnuts now? You know, years, almost 20 years later, it's your white whale. It's really stubborn. How do you think about this thing in your life?
Oh, that's a good question. It definitely, there are days of frustration, you know, but then you get out there in the field in the fall and you see the potential of these top plants. You see these plants just loaded with hazelnuts. And then, you know, you get them cracked down, roasted, and you're eating them. It's like, whoa, this is so worth pursuing. Again, harvest time is my favorite, because you go in there and you start digging around in the plants looking for the nuts, right, to harvest them. And in there, it's just like this whole world of insect activity. Katydids, walking sticks all over the place, tree frogs, moth larvae. I mean, it's just this whole world that you've brought into the agricultural field that wasn't there before. You know, it'd be so great if the American consumer could experience fresh roasted hazelnuts, not the stuff that gets imported from Turkey, and we could grow it in the Midwest and actually have a nut crop that farmers could benefit from. You know, you go out to Oregon and or California, and nuts are huge and they're really lucrative, profitable crops. Our growers in the Midwest don't have crop like it. So that's what keeps me going, is the potential.
You're tackling these challenges, you know, trying to solve problems for the people that might follow you, but you're working on long timescales here.
Yeah, and I've been at it long enough now, we're definitely seeing generational change. So there was a group of early adopter growers that I started working with, and now they've aged out. They've either died or just retired out. And so now I'm working with a whole new cohort. You know, we want younger active farmers that are ready to take on a 15 to 20 year project, because we feel like we're far enough along and that we can start scaling production. So we're seeing that it's shifting from kind of the retiree folks to a younger, more production oriented group. But that's plant breeding. That's woody crop development, is you're standing on shoulders of generations before and you carry the torch for a while and eventually you get it.
Mm-hmm.
I just can sustain the effort long enough.
Jason Fishbach is the co-leader of the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Institute. He, along with a group of hazelnut curious farmers, spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. This story is a part of Climate Solutions Week. WUWM and the NPR Network are dedicating this week to stories about climate solutions with a focus on food. You can find more stories at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow will join me to talk about a project she's debuting next week. But first, we'll speak with the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District about the changes he's seen in the city's green infrastructure over the past 22 years. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Things like rain barrels or rain gardens are pretty common in the Milwaukee area for both businesses and residential homes. But at the beginning of Kevin Schaefer's tenure leading the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, it was extremely hard to convince people about the benefits of green infrastructure. In fact, MMSD was very unpopular, even hated, when Schaefer first started working there as an engineer. During the so-called sewer wars, Milwaukee's sewer system released untreated wastewater into streams, rivers, and Lake Michigan an average of 60 times a year. Today, that's down to just a couple of times. That's thanks in large part to Schaefer's leadership of MMSD since 2002. His time and work with the organization is highlighted in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. And to share more about his tenure with MMSD, Kevin Schaefer joins me now. Kevin, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here.
Audrey, it's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Of course. So before you took over as executive director at MMSD in 2002, you were running the district's engineering department starting in 98. So can you set the scene for me? What brought you to Milwaukee and what were your first impressions of the job and the atmosphere you were coming into?
Yeah, well, when I graduated from school, I went and worked for the Army Corps of Engineers for 6 years. And then I worked for private industry for 9 years after that. And it was through those final few years in private industry that I got to know MMSD. And the previous executive director interviewed and hired me to run the engineering division here at the district. And I started in October of 1998. And I just really, I wasn't here for the sewer war, so I wasn't here for all that background noise that was going on. But it was just a great challenge to be able to run an engineering department of, I don't know, 50 people, and to have such a great mission that we were working on. So it just seemed like a good fit for me.
When did your interest in water resources and quality start?
You know, it probably started when I was a kid. Grew up in central Illinois. My grandparents had a farm, so I remember doing a lot of fun things in creeks and handling cow manure and things like that. So it was just something that I kind of acquired as I grew up.
And you mentioned the sewer wars that were happening before you came on to MMSD. For anyone who's unfamiliar or maybe doesn't remember it, can you explain why MMSD was not very popular, to say it kindly?
Well, in 1972, the Clean Water Act passed, and almost immediately after that, the city of Milwaukee was sued for combined sewer and separate sewer overflows into Lake Michigan by my home state, Illinois and Chicago. And so we were forced at that time to build the deep tunnel and to make improvements to our treatment plants. And so the sewer wars was a discussion about, it was a battle. It was a battle over who was going to pay for the deep tunnel and for some of those improvements, basically pitting the in Milwaukee County communities against the out of Milwaukee County communities.
And a big issue during this time was untreated wastewater overflowing into lakes and rivers. That was up to 60 times a year at that point.
Yeah, that's correct. We averaged 50 to 60 per year. So that was, I mean, there's much more than that in some years. And it was about 8 to 9 billion gallons of wastewater going into the rivers and into Lake Michigan every year on average.
Yeah, obviously today it's very rare for this to happen, but a lot happened in between that, right, to get us to where we are. And when you started as MMSD's executive director in 2002, what were some of the most pressing challenges you were facing at first?
Well, there was a lot of media attention, none of it real positive. And one of the things that was happening at the time was when we finished completion of the deep tunnel in 1994, We let an algorithm, a computer algorithm, kind of manage the tunnel system. And up until 2002, we would basically have an overflow if the tunnel was half full, because we were saving that extra space for future rainfalls. And, you know, rightfully so, we were getting a lot of poor media coverage because we still had half the storage available and not using it. So in 2002, when I became executive director, first thing I did was change that. And instead of a computer making that call, I said, you know, if I'm going to be out in the media defending an overflow, I want to be the one that makes that decision. So I guess I took the horns and said, I'm going to make this happen and I'm going to do the call myself. And that meant a lot of 2 o'clock in the morning phone calls, all night wake ups, just trying to manage storms. And but what it did was it really brought a more personal touch to what we were doing. And I think the public appreciated that.
Especially given that you were a new leader, I imagine you were nervous about taking on this role and people were most likely skeptical of you, right? So what's your leadership style and how do you think it helped you either establish new relationships or repair old ones?
Well, I'm a pretty calm guy. I try not to get too worked up out on the outside for folks to see the issues. And so I really just started looking at what the problems were and quietly working towards solutions on that, whether it was an internal project that we were working on or whether it was working with the 28 municipalities, their mayors and village presidents, just going out and meeting with them, giving them a personal relationship with me, allowing them to call me if they needed to on anything. And I mean, my staff would tell you, and I, you know, I think it's true, I don't get into the weeds on some of these issues. I try to kind of hover above that and make sure that they're pointed in the right direction. But the day-to-day calls on a lot of things, I really have my staff do a lot of that decision-making.
Another big part of the shift you helped kind of lead was an emphasis on education in relation to public relations, because people can easily see the result of wastewater overflow, right? But do they understand the process necessarily? So why did you feel, let's help everyone understand what actually happens in our water system?
Yeah, and thank you, Audrey, because that was one of the big changes early on. We would have an overflow and people would not understand why and what the mechanisms were and what the background was on that. So one of the things I also started doing was, I call it sewer school. I'm still doing sewer school. And I go around to nonprofit groups, schools, communities, Rotaries, Kiwanians groups, and talk about how the system works. But one thing that I did do, which was different, and it's different than what most utilities in the country today are doing, is I connected it to the entire watershed. I said, we cannot just look at our own political boundaries. The Milwaukee River comes downstream right through our sewer area, and it's got a huge drainage area up above us. So we really need to look at nature's boundaries, which is that watershed boundary, and start managing all types of flows on the watershed scale. And so that's the message I've been pushing with the sewer school effort, talking about how we manage stormwater, how do we manage wastewater, how do we integrate these systems so that they can work together to make our lives better.
Given that it takes a lot of time to steer the ship right, so with the tumultuous environment you're coming into, it didn't go away overnight. And in 2009, you almost quit MMSD. But what was the turning point for you that helped you make the decision to stay and to essentially commit your foot to the gas?
So in 2009, my dad passed away. And I thought, if I'm going to make a change, I need to make it now, because I wasn't sure that I would make it going forward. And I thought, well, let's make the change. We'll see what happens. It's either going to be really quick or, you know, I'll be here a while. So what I did was I stepped back from everything they were doing. And I thought about a milestone year of the year 2035. And I said, what do I want the district to look like in the year 2035? So I wrote in 2009, I wrote a vision for the year 2035. It really was focused on integrated watershed management and climate change. And in 2009, although we were living it then, it was still not widely accepted that the climate was changing. So put some pretty drastic or hard goals within that vision, and hit the send key thinking, well, you know, I'm either here for a while or I'm packing up tomorrow. And my commission wanted to extend it. So they wanted to have their own vision. So they formed a committee, took my vision that I wrote in 2009 and basically approved that same vision in early 2010. And really, that vision is still driving us today. We're 11 years away from that vision being complete. And it was a great motivator for staff. They were able to look at this and say, okay, we're going to take these steps. We're going to install green infrastructure. We're going to take these steps to try to address climate change, while still meeting our permit with the state and federal government and doing better than those permit requirements.
What's the current main issue that you're prioritizing right now for MMSD? I know a lot of projects happen together and along the same timeline, but what stands out to you?
Everything's integrated, just like you said. It's all a kind of a puzzle that fits together, but we really have to turn our attention to climate change and really target these unique storms that we're seeing throughout the country now, the droughts that we're seeing that are causing fires, you know, just it's a huge task that we have to embark on. And again, I think focusing that discussion on a watershed makes sense, because the impacts of climate change will be felt with air and with water. And so using nature's boundary for water, it makes sense to try to manage that resilience effort through different steps throughout the watershed. So we're purchasing land and keeping it from being developed along the waterways where it would be flooded. We're working with farmers upstream to do better farm practices to reduce pollution and runoff from their farms. We're working in the urban core of the city and in the suburbs to install green infrastructure, which is just taking nature's approach to managing stormwater, allowing it to infiltrate or to store it in rain barrels or in ditches or whatever, to try to keep it out of the sewers and to clean it before it gets into the river. So we're really looking at all these different puzzle pieces fitting together.
As some of the projects you mentioned, you know, it's kind of easy to take our surroundings for granted or not know the work a bioswale does as we drive past it. So can you share how Milwaukee and MMSD is a leader in innovation in this field? For example, what do you share with other people and organizations around the world about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I've gone to China, I've gone to different places throughout the United States talking about green infrastructure and really talking about how we need to manage that drop of rainfall where it falls. And really, it's really talking to people and going back to some of the very basic education that they had maybe in grade school, talking about the hydrologic cycle and how to manage water. So we focus on different elements of green infrastructure. The first one that we implemented was a rain barrel program. And, you know, I remember going to my son's eighth grade graduation and people laughing at me because I was promoting to put rain barrels at the bottom of downspouts. But as those efforts grew and as more and more came into operation, we're seeing more water being captured off those rooftops instead of going into the sewer system. So rain barrels, bioswales, as you talked about, a lot of the money that we're spending on green infrastructure, we actually give back to the communities. So the city of Milwaukee's done a magnificent job with some of the bioswales on their roadways. Whitefish Bay, I just drove through there yesterday and saw some beautiful bioswales. None of that would be there if MMSD had not pushed the green infrastructure program and paid for it. We're paying for almost all of that.
Nowadays, you see rain barrels almost at every other house. A lot of people are doing rain gardens and their own personal landscaping. What are some of your favorite projects that you pass by in your day-to-day?
Yeah, well, I always laugh when I'm walking the dog in the morning when I see a rain barrel because you never saw those before. So it's very satisfying to see that. You know, Pulaski Park is a flood management project, but we went into that park in partnership with Milwaukee County Parks. And we removed the concrete lining from that waterway and naturalized that creek as it flows through the park and then rebuilt the park so that it brings back better recreational components to the community. So really seeing that tie-in between the social benefits of better recreation, safe places for children to play, better places for families to gather, along with flood management, all kind of integrated into the same space, is very satisfying for me because you're getting multiple benefits for the same dollar amount.
Is it that satisfaction that's kept you at MMSD?
Oh, you know, we do something different every day. And it's that change, that always looking to be better, the efforts to try to make this community more resilient to climate change with less flooding. That's the stuff that brings me every day. And mostly it's working with some really phenomenal people here at the district. We have a great lab staff. We have great monitoring crews out in the field, engineering, accounting, my legal staff. Everyone is so passionate about what we do. And, you know, we're really hiring some great young talent now. And a lot of them say that they're coming to MMSD because they like the vision and the mission of what we're trying to do for the environment. So it's a win-win for everyone. And I just love the people that I work with.
Kevin Schaefer is the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. You can find a profile of him in this month's Milwaukee magazine titled The Cleaner. From sculptures to murals, public art is everywhere in Milwaukee. But what does Milwaukee's public art say about the city itself? That's what WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly will be asking over the course of her series, Reflections of Representation. She'll be exploring the public art that defines Milwaukee's image and how that art does or doesn't reflect the city's diverse communities. I'm joined now by Nadia so she can share more. Hey, Nadia, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Audrey, thank you so much.
So can you tell us a bit more about the series that you've been working on? I'm excited for it.
Yeah, for sure. So it's called Reflections of Representation. It's a three-part series that is a collection of stories about Milwaukee and Wisconsin's public arts and how that defines the city's image and how it represents the people who live here or doesn't represent the people who live here in some cases. With the projects, I'm really interested at getting at what does public art here say about Milwaukee? I think a lot of people think public art is a way of beautifying a neighborhood or memorializing a person. And there is value in that. But I think when a city or a business owner or somebody builds an image of something that's really visible, largely visible by everyone in the community into our environment, that can end up being really significant. Something that sets you apart from other cities, helps develop a city's identity. It has the potential to really unify people and make people proud of where they live. But if it resonates with some people and not with others, it can also leave people feeling isolated and not seen in a place that they call home.
There's definitely a lot to dive into with this topic of public art. So what kind of stories will we be hearing over the course of this series next week?
I will be doing a story specifically looking at some of Milwaukee's oldest monuments and sort of talking about how historically, when you look at a lot of the monuments here and really nationally too, monuments are often told from a very specific perspective, specifically like a colonial perspective, like a white male perspective from like a war and conquest sort of perspective. And how having monuments depicting those narrow themes and perspectives, how that really leaves out a lot of the history of America. I also have a story about murals, specifically how murals are seen as more like community forms of expression and can highlight both the differences of a lot of the people that live here, but also how murals can really play a part in like uniting people, like bridging differences. And then I also have a story specifically about our recent Bell Phillips statue that was erected on the Capitol grounds a few months ago. I'm talking about the efforts that went into getting that statue on the Capitol grounds, talking to some key players who were instrumental in that effort and what the impact of that statue has been so far.
That's great. I actually saw it for the first time myself the other weekend when I went up to the farmer's market. It's a fantastic addition to everything on the Capitol Square. And for all this public art in Milwaukee and even traveling to Madison, what inspired you to do this project ultimately?
What specifically sparked my interest in public art? I'm originally from Rosenberg, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. And for college, I decided to go to Boston to study music. And it was like my first time so far away from home. And I was, you know, kind of feeling like, I guess a little out of place is the best way to describe it. But I think what was really helpful in like grounding me was my dorm building was actually located right across from Commonwealth Avenue, which is a very long street in Boston. There's a lot of historical monuments there. And like right across from my dorm building, there was a statue of a woman named Phyllis Wheatley. If you don't know who Phyllis Wheatley is, she is the first published African-American author of a book of poetry. She's originally from Africa, but she was brought to Boston because she was, you know, kidnapped and sold into slavery. But the people who owned her actually encouraged her to, like, they taught her to read and write. And she eventually became really successful. And actually, as she grew as a writer, a lot of her themes evolved from, like, expressing, like, themes of, like, religion to using, like, religious themes as a, maybe, like, a metaphor is the best way of saying it, to, like, critique the institutions of slavery and also to, like, reference her own African culture. Seeing that statue, it really resonated with me because I guess it helped spark this sense of belonging for me in Boston, because even though I wasn't from Boston, like Phyllis wasn't from Boston. And so it made me feel like I could belong there. And also, I feel that with this statue, it also was the beginning of my own personal relationship with Boston. And it inspired me to learn more about like colonial America, both from like the perspective that we're taught in schools, like from, you know, the patriotic colonial perspective, and also from the perspective of the people who were harmed by colonialism and the institution of slavery. And like thinking about and learning about all that history, it let me ask myself, like, how do I fit into all of that? I was just really interested in the idea of public art as like an entryway to a larger conversation about people, our relationship to where we live, and how that all influences our identity.
Thank you for sharing that story about your time in Boston. I really liked that insight and your experience. So when you were thinking about the Milwaukee Project here and exploring art around the city, what kind of conversations were you having with people on the topic of representation through art?
I think from what I found from talking to people, talking to artists and community members and experts, is that when we were talking about representation in public art, representation is where is how we began our conversations, but it wasn't necessarily the end of those conversations. My conversations with people was just as much about history and the way we tell stories of our past as it is about public art and how we decide to tell like the evolving stories of the people who make up Milwaukee today and from what perspectives we tell those stories. One of the people that I talked to for my series was Paul Farber, who is the director of a nonprofit organization called Monument Lab, who does a lot of work in researching public monuments and what that tells us about our country's values. And something that he said really stuck with me. He said that history lives with people, not necessarily in objects. And I think that was really interesting because public art was just a really great entryway for me and for the people that I was talking to just learn more about the people who came before us in our city and the people that, you know, live right next to us.
And that series, again, is called Reflections of Representation, and it'll be airing next week. For today, Nadia, thanks so much for joining me to share more.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Nadia Kelly is WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow. You can listen to her series, Reflections of Representation, starting Monday on Lake Effect. We'll take one more break, and then we'll learn about a program at MATC that supports students with autism. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. College can be a difficult transition for any student, and for students with autism, it can present even more challenges. Most students with autism require some extra support with their classwork, which can be difficult in standard programs. Milwaukee Area Technical College wanted to help students with autism navigate college more easily, so they created the Uniquely Abled Academy, a program inside of the college specifically created with autistic students in mind. Terry Wozick is a machine tool instructor who works with the program, and Ethan Tutaj Blaze participated in the program. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
Tell me a bit about the Uniquely Abled Academy and how it's set up.
The Uniquely Abled Academy was set up to encourage highly functioning autistic people to come in and get trained in our machine tool area as a starting point to help them be successful in the job field. The machine tool area is an area where they would be able to excel at. And we thought it was a great opportunity for the students to come in and give it a try.
When you say machine tool area, what does that entail? What kind of future careers come out of that kind of program?
Manufacturing based. It's you know, machine shops that have CNC machines, computerized numerical controlled machines, that some semi-automated, learning the ins and the outs of how to set up and operate and run them, using all the precision measuring tools, you know, basically our workforce needs to have employable people that have these skill sets. And we're here doing the training that offers that. So in manufacturing, you could be manufacturing plastic injection parts. You could be machining aluminum parts or anything for automotive industry to food industry or even to surgical equipment stuff. So machining is a well-rounded career for people to start out as a basically being a machine operator, work themselves up to a lead man, a lead person, set up an operation, even CNC programming.
As you said, this program is geared toward what it describes as people with high functioning autism. Why is this program a better fit for people than what might be your typical college course?
Well, it's the difference between a four-year degree and a two-year degree. Here at MATC, we pride ourselves on getting the students on hands-on. We take them to the shops. We get them manufacturing parts, usually within 2 to 3 days of being in the machine shop, on the machines, teaching the ins and outs. And we also have the related classes that go along with that, like the math and the blueprint reading and measuring tool metrology, stuff like that. So it's geared for them to get onto the machines and get some industry experience, you know, manufacturing parts right away. Whereas a four-year degree, you have a lot more book work and less hands-on experience. That's in my personal opinion, of course.
Yeah. One of the other things I would definitely say is that my peers who went through this program with me, one of the things is that they tended to need more time for information to be soaked up in order to understand why we're doing a certain procedure and how we're going to do it. So this program will provide them with more time to get that down.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense to me. Ethan, is that part of what attracted you to the program, or was it more about the jobs? Why did you decide to start with this program?
So I was working at COPS in the summer. I had originally planned to take a gap here. I didn't exactly know what kind of career I wanted to go in. School wasn't exactly my thing. I would have loved to be a particle physicist. That's a step beyond quantum physics. However, the thing is, I hate English classes. I wasn't the best when it came down to schoolwork. And going to trade school offered me much less of the classes I knew I would do much worse in. And it would make college much more tolerable. So when we heard about this program, I like working with my hands. I'm strong in math. It seemed like a great fit to kind of get into a field that I could get a job and not sit around at home all day.
Sure. When you think about the kind of coursework you've done at MATC, and this is really a question for both Ethan and Terry, how does it differ in your view from what you anticipated from a college course?
So I originally anticipated it to be much more like a traditional college where you get loads of homework, you have a certain amount of time to do that. It's way more expensive. So when we did this, I was shocked and I saw the price. It was really cheap, really affordable to do this program. And that was a big thing. Colleges, the prices are going up. Moving into this field, I had no idea what to expect either. I thought it was going to be like when you're welding, you have sparks flying everywhere. And I quickly found out that's not the case.
So I look at this program as a place where new students can enroll in this as career path. And it's where we mold them. If they make a mistake, I'd rather have them make it in a learning environment than when they get to a shop or a manufacturing facility and make mistakes. You know, if we make mistakes, we learn from them, we move on. Hopefully we're teaching the proper habits and critical thinking to prevent the mistakes from being a continual habitual problem. Our manufacturing companies within our Milwaukee regional area, they appreciate that we go and take our time and thoroughly instruct the small things, the attention to detail, measuring devices, how to say the proper terms and talk in machine shop talk and information. It makes their transition from being a student to an employee very seamless. The industry really appreciates that we take the care and the time. And all of our instructors here at MATC have been in industry, so we know what to expect as what we're trying to send our students out to be.
Sure. Well, Terry, Ethan, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing a bit of what you do at MATC.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Terry Wozzik is a machine tool instructor at MATC, and Ethan Tutaj-Blaze participated in MATC's Uniquely Abled Academy. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Xgrit Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Lena Tran, Chuck Kornbach, and Susan Benz from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. You'll see a referendum question on your ballot this November. On Monday, we'll tell you what the question is and what a yes or no vote would mean. Plus, we'll tell you about Milwaukee's King Community Center and what it provides for the community. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.